I was amazed to learn that you play generally without a score. And even usually without a light on the keyboard. So you play by touch and you watch the screen. It seems to me that that method must really allow you to stay engaged with the film in the moment and allow what you play to be something that is really engaged with the experience of the film and triggered by the film, rather than something that you're imposing on the film or something that you're doing simultaneously while the film's going on.
Yeah, well, I hope so, certainly. I should say my method of doing it kind of came about by accident, and it was sort of dictated by the conditions of the first sort of bookings that I had. The first major employer that I had was the National Film Theatre in London, which is now the BFI Southbank. We're talking about 86, 87 is when I started. So this is pre-internet, pre-DVDs, just, you know, VCRs and television, and very little silent material on either. So when I started at the National Film Theatre, they had established this tradition of not showing the films to the pianists beforehand. So their pianists would just come in to the public screening and play for the film blind. Blind meaning, you know, that was the first time they'd seen it, was the public performance. So I kind of went along with that. So the first 10 years or so of accompanying silent films, virtually everything I accompanied publicly, you know, that was the first time I'd seen the film. I always probably would have improvised in some fashion, because, you know, you can't compose original music for two-hour film after two-hour film. You know, it's just, you're talking about symphonies worth of music, you know. So you do need to extemporize to a certain extent. But the playing while watching the screen came really from that. It was forced upon me to a certain extent. And I remember the first time I played there, when the lights went out and the keyboard disappeared, that was pretty much the first time I'd played by touch as well. But now it's sort of second nature to me. This is a very roundabout answer to your question, but I think for me it does help me to respond to the film from moment to moment. I have ideas in my head, certainly, and I do prepare some music, but the application of it to the film is moment to moment. I wouldn't sort of put it above any other way of doing it. It's just the way I do it. I do these days tend to have a light, actually, but that's more because I incorporate other instruments, and I just practically need to be able to see, to pick up the other instruments and find out where my fingers are and everything like that. But as far as the piano is concerned, I'm, you know, 80-90% doing it by touch.
The first film that you accompanied, I read, was The Passion of Joan of Arc by Carl Dreyer.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
And again, it was a film that you'd never seen before, in addition to never having accompanied silent film before.
Well, on that occasion, that was a kind of local film society run by an ex-school teacher of mine. And she asked me to do it. I probably, you know, quite possibly wouldn't have got into silent films at all if it hadn't been for that experience. She just asked me if I would consider. She knew that I composed and improvised, so she asked if I would consider doing it for that performance. What happened was she came to my house and she projected one reel onto a wall. So I saw like the first 15 minutes or so before the screening, and then after that everything was blind.
I have to ask, what do you think the rationale for imposing that restriction that the performer can't see the film beforehand? It seems like there's a real desire to avoid any of the artificiality that might result from having too much of an intellectual study of the film.
You know, I'd like to say that there was probably a rationale behind it, but I'm pretty sure it was economic more than anything, or practical. I know from the point of view of the National Film Theatre in those days, it was primarily practical, in that, you know, they couldn't make screeners in those days. I think if a video or the film was available, they would have been quite happy to make it available. But you're talking about a three-screen cinema that shows films all day, 7 days a week. Just practically for the musician to get a screening of the film, they had to... I did have it once or twice. They scheduled screenings for me, but I had to go in to the projectionist booth. They had to run it for me on a, you know, a desk, or even in the cinema. So that projectionist had to be booked for that two-hour slot. Quite often the prints were coming from abroad. They weren't necessarily from the BFI archive. Often they would arrive just the day before. It was just practically not very easy for them to do it. And then I know the moment that I kind of, as soon as I discovered I could get away with doing it without seeing the film before, I was quite happy to accept that, because to see it before was an extra half day out of my life. You know, I'd have to travel to central London, see the film, come back, that's another half day. You don't get any more money. And I think that was it, really. And the other pianists had just, everyone just fell in with that way of doing it. It was just a practical decision. Whether aesthetically something good came out of that, I would say probably it did, but I wouldn't necessarily say that you play better if you don't see the film before. I don't think that's actually the case. Some people think that, and it can work very well sometimes, but generally speaking, you know, I would say if you can see the film before, why not, to be honest.
You said that dramas have maybe a wider scope of possibilities for you. That seems true of the performances I've seen you do. It seems like you're very good at responding to the emotional nuances of a given scene, and rather than Mickey Mousing the action, or even Mickey Mousing the emotions, you're still following very closely with the emotional turns in the dynamics within a scene, and giving an accompaniment that does just what it's supposed to do in terms of underscoring the emotional changes without drawing attention to itself or overwhelming what's happening, but just allowing us access, better access to what we're seeing.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I hope so. Firstly, I would want to put playing for comedy on a lower level than anything else. They can be some of the most enjoyable events, you know, because a really good comedy is a crowd pleaser like none other, really. And the challenge for me there more is to do with timing, and, you know, even to a certain extent, Mickey Mousing. I don't actually think a bit of Mickey Mousing's a bad thing, but yes, for me personally, I find with comedy, it's pretty straightforward. The choices, you know, and you know, the range of musical styles is a bit more limited. But with drama, I do like sound film scores that are synchronized with the film, which is not the same thing as Mickey Mousing. You know, I do think you need to hit certain beats. You know, but they're emotional and narrative, dramatic. But I think music can also say more than one thing at a time, and it can tell you more than one thing about what's going on in the scene. Certainly, I aim for that. It's nice when the music is both directly referring to what's on the screen, but also perhaps telling you something else at the same time. It's a very hard thing to define, but when it works, it's great. I think sometimes the music can draw your attention to specific things in a scene that you wouldn't necessarily notice, you know, as an audience member seeing a film for the first time. You can highlight certain things within the frame, if you like.
The first time I saw you perform was with Henry King's adaptation of Stella Dallas, the first adaptation from 1925.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it was profound for me, because I think before that point I just had an intellectual interest in sound films as an era of film history, and I did not expect that I could be actually emotionally moved by sound films until that performance. I know you told the story of having played with it, I think, the first time for Kevin Brownlow.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah.
And discovering that it was a masterpiece while you were playing. So I wonder if you could say some things about the kinds of things from a film like Stella Dallas that attract you to playing with it.
Well, Stella Dallas is sort of a gift to a musician, really, because it's such a powerful film, sort of cumulatively. Like all films, it doesn't speak to everyone. I've met some people who have remained unmoved by it, which I find extraordinary. But the power of that film, I found, provided a great opportunity for musical understatement, which seemed to sort of have an amplifying effect on the emotion in a strange kind of way. I always aim for moments of silence in my scores, if it's possible. And with that film, with the sort of final climax, I consciously played as quietly as possible because the emotion was so loud, if you like. Sorry, I forgot what the question was.
just examples of the kinds of things that really attract you to accompanying a film, because I know then you took it around and played it, you know, as often as you could.
I tried to. I aimed for that. I've played for it relatively rarely, actually. There is a problem with that film. For many years, it was unavailable. What happened was, after the Kevin Brownlow private screening, that was his personal 60 millimeter copy, so it wasn't available for public screenings. But I sort of wrote to venues asking if they could put it on, but it turned out that it was not available. There was just a 60mm print at MoMA and UCLA, but they weren't in good enough condition for them to allow them to be shown. But I had a couple of screenings. It turned out that there was a print in Brussels, probably not completely a legal print. And I played for Kevin's print at a couple of other private shows. But fortunately, UCLA has struck another print, which was the one that was shown last year. I recently played for that again at the Library of Congress. Every time I play for it, you know, it has this amazing effect on people. I think particularly, as you would imagine, mothers and daughters seem to, you know, mothers just, you know, are sort of incapable afterwards, and daughters want to go up and hug their mothers. It's very sort of, I've seen that happen, you know, mothers and daughters sort of embracing after screenings of that film. It's sort of, it's very touching. I'd love, the film I think still needs restoration. I'd love it to be put on DVD and stuff, but we'll see.
The understatement that you speak of comes up at several points in the film. It has these kind of, what I think of as emotional set pieces to it. Mm. One of the great ones is when Stella and her daughter Laurel are preparing for Laurel's birthday party. And Laurel is practicing how she's going to answer the door in a really courtly way.
I know, it's a heartbreaker, isn't it?
Right, and she's very excited about greeting everyone. And then time passes, and finally you see these girls stepping out of a car down on the street, and you think they're going to come up to her party. Mm. And Henry King really masterfully draws out the approach of the girls so that you see their feet on the stairs, and then you see Laurel go and open the door and come out to greet them, and they just pass right by her, you know, go up past her landing. And I think that was one of the moments where you really briefly dropped out just as they go up past her.
Quite possibly, yes. I mean, you know, it wasn't scored, so I think what I did with that moment was actually a sort of almost a Mickey Mousing moment of playing the footsteps coming up and then fading away just as they come alongside her, because I think there's a sort of slight pause in the film anyway, and then the feet carry on up the stairs, and that's when you realise that they haven't arrived for her. I do find that sometimes at moments of most, you know, when the emotion is most amplified, somehow to play quietly mirrors that in a strange kind of way. And I think it's because it's like the musical equivalent of an intake of breath. You know, if there's a shock moment as well, you know, quite often when people are deeply shocked, they're speechless. Or they may draw in breath. And it's kind of like it's that moment, sort of transmogrified into music. And also because it's a strange kind of inverted thing that if you've been playing music continuously for a certain amount of time, it can become a sort of a wallpaper thing, you know. Or it becomes the score of the film in people's minds. They're getting into the film and there's this music going on, and then suddenly there's silence. And in a weird kind of way, silence draws attention to the music. It's a good trick, to be honest. But you know, you can't make absolute statements because there are times when, you know, loud on film needs loud music. You know, say a battle scene. If you've got explosions going off, you know, you're not going to sort of play those quietly. That would be sort of perverse for the sake of it, really.
Another powerful quiet moment was when Laurel and Stella are in the sleeping compartment.
Oh yeah,
and they're both hearing these other girls talk about Stella and describe her as a millstone around Laurel's neck and saying these things that make it clear that Stella's always going to be holding her daughter back if she continues to be too prominent. And I remember that moment, I think you went quiet as well. And that really worked. That was really powerful.
Well, that was, in a way, that was directly reflecting what's going on the screen, because they're listening to these voices. And you see them in close-up, sort of straining to hear what's being said, because the voices are coming through the compartment wall. So that was, to me, a sort of no-brainer, really. I think I did a kind of a slightly abstract effect. I think I strummed on the strings of the piano or something to try and create...
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, the equivalent of, you know, indistinct noises. Actually, I have to say, for me, you know, another... things like... similarly to Mickey Mousing, one thing that is sometimes discussed as to whether or not it's something you should do is diegetic music. You know, do you try and mirror sounds that are directly referred to within the film? And sometimes you have to, and sometimes it's best not to. But for me, the sort of the mother load, if you like, is where you do it, but at the same time, it's mirroring emotionally what's going on. So in a way, that's an example. You know, you kind of make an abstract sound which is kind of the equivalent of what they might be hearing, but the effect that you create within the score is equivalent to the emotional effect as well. It's putting the audience into a different sort of sound world, and that can sometimes reflect the different emotional world. It's all very convoluted. But.
No, that makes sense. I can't think of an example from Stella Dallas.
Yeah, I've got one from Stella Dallas. At the end, when she sees the wedding from outside the window, there's a moment where she's coming down the staircase and there's a band and they strike up the wedding march. At first, I didn't want to play the wedding march because that's such a cliche, but I could tell from the movement on the way they're playing the instruments that it was, you know, here comes the bride. And you're inside the house and you see them play those notes. And then it cuts to outside the house. You see Stella Dallas react because she's heard the music, and then she goes to the window and she watches the wedding from outside the window. So what I did was I played the wedding march, but the moment we cut to outside, I tried to make it as quiet as possible. So it's a literal reflection of the sound. You know, she hears the wedding march, but, you know, the sudden change of volume also has an emotional effect.
It reinforces the contrast of where she is in relation she's seeing.
So that's, for me, you know, when you're reaping maximum rewards, if you like, you feel very clever as well as a musician. Yeah, it's a good opportunity to show off.
It seems like you must pay attention both to the emotional dynamics and also to the filmic language. I wonder if that's something that you notice and absorb and try and pay attention to is, I know that, you know, you do obvious things like dropping out, it fades out. Mm-hmm. But I wonder if you're also aware of other filmic figures like sudden close-ups, mm-hmm. Or scenes with extended superimposition, mm-hmm. and that those things must also be something you respond to in addition to the content of the film.
Definitely. I mean, obviously, I think I probably have a pretty good understanding of film language now. I always love film anyway, and I see films in my leisure time anyway. I wouldn't say that I necessarily analyze it, you know, in the way that a film studies person would, but it's quite intuitive, really. There are certain cinematic tropes that just instinctively lend themselves to some kind of musical parallel. One thing that I find with silent films, and I don't know if it's in my imagination just because, you know, I like silent films, but I feel that the effects that they apply tend to have greater impact than equivalent effects these days. For example, a camera move, you know. A camera move in a silent film directed, you know, by a great director tends for me to somehow have greater effect than, I mean, camera moves now, you know, with the, you know, steady cam and everything, you know, the camera can go everywhere, you know, can go, and with CGI is, you know, literally anything is possible. And yet in silent films, because it's so hard to move the camera, you may have one camera moving an entire film. But they, if it was a good director, they really chose that moment. And so it's there for a purpose. It's not just the director showing off. So I suppose, for example, when something like that happens, when the camera moves, it usually means something within a silent film in a way that it wouldn't now necessarily. And so I try and amplify that in some way. But, it, you know, it's a sort of, music exists in a parallel world, so a camera move might be reflected by, you know, a change of key or you know, increase in volume, decrease in volume, all these kind of things. Or silence again. It just depends on the context. So, yeah. I think I try and draw attention to the, in that way, to what's going on visually.
And one of the filmic figures in Stella Dallas that really works is the memory cutaways or memory inserts that come up just a couple of times in the film. I was really moved by Stella's daughter telling her about her day at the fancy summer camp with high society young people. And she says that today Richard Grofsner and I, and then we cut to see what she did with this boy, and they went in the pool and went down underwater, and the cut from her recounting it to seeing what she's recounting gives such a more visceral sense of you know, what a, you know, dream-like experience it was to be with this boy on a sunny day and be under the water. Yeah, there's some extra impact of what a dream come true it was for her to do that.
Yeah, I don't remember what I did in San Francisco for that, but when I played it at the Library of Congress recently, when we cut to them underwater, I switched from piano to flute as a sort of, just because, you know, if you suddenly create a different sound world, you know, it's a bit like the different world we're in, you know, underwater in the scene. So that would be an example, I guess, of you know, reflecting the visual with the musical. There's also the flashback in when she, you know, later in the movie, she remembers the women talking, the girls talking. And I think I certainly did recently, I sort of had a, you know, a little fragment of the music that I played the first time we saw the scene, but in this sort of quiet, sort of, you know, memorized way, if you like, slightly distorted. So it's like memory, really. Slightly distorted.
Another film I've seen you accompany was one of the recent program of Hitchcock Nines, his 29 film, The Manxman.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That film I find surprising for how much power it has in its pictorial language and the way that things like composition can express really frank and powerful emotional truths about this love triangle that includes an illicit affair and a child born out of wedlock in this little fishing village in the Isle of Man. And I think it has several examples of some of the things that we've been talking about. And maybe the most profound one is this moment when the young barmaid has promised herself to this fisherman, and he's presumed dead. And Hitchcock draws out, you know, the audience's discovery of how the girl feels about it, in a way. We see her in the background across this room full of people, and there's a moment finally where she whips around and looks into the camera, and it's that's a powerful example of the silence allowing us to hear the audience actually draw in breath when we're surprised, because what she says is, now we're free. She expresses the exact opposite of what we think. Even though we know that she's been having an affair, it's still profound that she's someone we thought was so innocent says this.
Well, they haven't been having an affair at that moment. They've been, you know, he's been looking after her while his friend is away. But it's clear from the very first scene that she's more interested in him than she is in the guy who was probably her childhood sweetheart, but he's no longer, you know, glamorous to her, like this guy who's going to be, you know, the great loyal Deemster, I think it's called in the film. So they've obviously been falling in love, but not sort of, they haven't acknowledged it to each other yet. They've been sort of flirting, I guess. That was a tricky scene, actually, because although it's wonderfully made, the guy, Malcolm Keane, the actor, is not. If you see it more than once, you'll probably become increasingly aware that he's not the best actor. And just before she says we're free, there's a close-up on him in which he gives this expression which quite often gets a laugh. So, because when I first scored that, I actually wanted silence during his expression, sort of like, you know, we're in expectation, like just as he is, you know, of what she's going to say. But I found a couple of times, you know, that silence would be filled with laughter, which was unfortunate. So I continued the music over his expression and cut it to silence just when we go back to her, because, you know, she's a good actress and she delivers the line well. So, but it's essentially the same way of doing it, you know, sort of just as Hitchcock does, draw out the moment and then, you know, silence and then we're free and then dark rumble on the piano kind of thing.
I wonder if that film benefits from a modern audience's predisposition to condescend to how frank they think a film from that era could be, in that I think maybe we were even more surprised by her reaction because we don't expect a silent film to be so frank about the erotic dynamics going on.
That's probably true. I mean, to be honest, every silent films are continually surprising if you carry on looking at them, you know, for long enough. There's very little that is not at least referred to in some silent film somewhere. I suppose it kind of works both ways, because you could say a film now, if it was set in the modern day, would struggle to tell the same story because they just wouldn't hide, you know, they would just go off with each other. It's partly the context, the historical context of that film, and also the you know, it being set on the Isle of Man, which apparently at the time of when the novel was written, was, you know, there was a very strong religious element to that island. So I think that's a big part of that film, is sort of this unspoken sort of moral code that they're all living within. But yes, that you don't expect her to come out with that, that's for sure. That probably comes from the original book as well, to be fair. But her character, I think, is quite unexpected because she's quite unabashed, you know, the way she behaves. She's, you know, her performance is very erotic, really. And when they subsequently do start an affair, which was when they think he's, you know, he's dead, they, you know, the way she kind of clutches at him is very sort of quite carnal. It's great.
So there's this great visual moment when they're inside of a mill, and she approaches this big wheel machinery.
I know.
And she sets it in motion, and we understand that she's putting in motion something that's going to make sound that will cover them having sex. And then we switch to the reverse angle, and it's a long shot, so we can see them in this room together, and she slowly approaches him, the lawyer friend, and then clutches him at the end, right? And that's, again, the suspense of watching her walk towards him, and then that's the close of the scene. Maybe we see the outside of the mill at the end.
You have a close-up of them, the grinding mills.
Right.
It was the first of Hitchcock's sort of overt sexual visual puns, you know. It's basically... It's very literally bumping and grinding, if you like. That's Hitchcock for you.
Do you sense that the Manxman is a particular example of the evolution of Hitchcock being able to use pictorial power to communicate subtextual elements? I'm thinking of, like, there's an almost expressionist staging of the three of them in the house... at the end with the you know, the cottage that has a low roof, and I think the fisherman is in the middle, and the lawyer and her in the background, and that kind of staging has a powerful visual effect, even though it's simple in terms of the action.
Yes. Well, Hitchcock was, you know, he understood how, you know, the cinematic language from the get-go, really. I mean, even The Pleasure Garden, which is kind of a crazy, random film, you know, in terms of, you know, stylistically, it's very, you know, it's very fully formed. The Manx Man, yes, I would say, I mean, it's kind of completely fluent in its use of the language, and it's, but very sort of, it's very unforced. It's not striving for effect. There's one bit I was sort of playing for the other day, and it just sort of struck me in a way that it hadn't before, which is when you know, the husband comes back to the house after she's left him, and left the, you know, rather shockingly left the baby as well unattended, and he comes back all happy after a day at work, and, you know, gradually becomes aware that she's not in the house. And we always think of Hitchcock as, you know, moving the camera at every opportunity, but in that case, you know, the camera just stays in the one room while he goes in and out of all the other rooms looking for her. And, you know, I think a lesser director would have felt the need to follow him with the camera, but Hitchcock just sort of knew that it's actually, because we know that she's left him, because we've seen that in the previous scene, so we don't need to sort of follow him in and out of the rooms, so we know that he's going to get increasingly more agitated. So he just he just keeps the camera in the one place. It's very clever. Simple and clever at the same time. I don't know how much Hitchcock, you know, he was a very sort of, I wouldn't say anti-intellectual director, but he certainly, I don't get the impression that he really sort of analysed his language in the way that some directors might do. When you read the book, The Interview with Truffaut, he's very sort of unpretentious about things. I think I think whether he knew what he was doing or not, you know, there actually was a kind of intellectual side to what he was doing, but it was an instinctive one, if that's not a contradiction in terms. I mean, you don't know with Hitchcock how disingenuous he was, really, because, you know, he did, you know, his whole life was a kind of throwing up of smoke screens, wasn't it? So possibly he did think these things through in the way that, you know, subsequent film studies writers have done, but he certainly didn't admit it if he had. was a magician, really. So, you know, a magician doesn't give away his tricks.
His wife, Alma, co-wrote the screenplay for a film that you'll be doing this week called The Firstborn.
Yes.
And it's a Miles Mander film from 1928.
Mm.
And that film also concerns an adulterous affair as well as a secretly adopted child.
Yes, yeah.
Adopted baby. And it has many moments of things that we've been talking about, of striking visual figures, like a surprising handheld moving camera search through a room of a husband looking for his what he believes is his adulterous wife.
Yes, that film has been probably the primary film that has been cited as sort of, you know, evidence that Alma Revel probably had a greater influence on his style than, you know, has really been acknowledged previously. Well, I think everyone always knew that she was his greatest collaborator, but I think people begin to think that maybe the word Hitchcockian should apply to both Hitchcocks, not just Alfred. But, you know, at the same time, you don't want to take too much. One should not take credit away from Miles Mander. But then Miles Mander acted in The Pleasure Garden.
The most striking visual sequence, I thought, in The Firstborn is a moment when Miles Mander's character, Hugo, is being tempted by one of his wife's friends who's on a divan, and she gives him this evening paper, and she's beckoning him to come and sit with her, and he's rolling up the paper, and his hands are really working on this paper, and you get these, you know, first-person reverse shots of him working on this paper, and then, you know, increasing close-ups on her larger and larger as she's beckoning to him. And then finally you see him and the shadow of her hand on the wall.
Yeah.
And it seems representative of this style that he has in the film, of that it's inventive and comedic at the same time. It's a serious matter, but it's also funny, but has this great visual inventiveness that communicates the eros.
Yes, yes, that's right. Well, I think that's quite a British thing, is the sort of, you know, leavening dramatic moments with humour. I don't know, it's a sort of it's a bit like the Hitchcock thing, you know, never take anything too seriously. So there's kind of I think that's quite a factor of British silent cinema I've played for, is that they rarely stay serious for long. Or, you know, that they'll sprinkle comic moments into the most dramatic scenes. It can be difficult to play for sometimes, you know, because of that. But The Firstborn is, it has that kind of strange sort of uneasy quality all the way through. So that's you know, not too difficult when it's consistent. You know, that's fine.
I guess the last thing I want to ask you is just, a lot of us probably can't imagine what it would be like to improvise to something you've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
Just to have the lights go down and have to respond to a film.
Mm.
And I know you've said that the first one, at least with Passion of Joan of Arc, that it helped that you didn't know what you were doing.
Yeah.
But I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what it is to respond to something you're seeing for the first time and be able to let go and trust that you can you can produce something that'll work with it.
Well, it's a difficult question, because it's, for me, it's a very, you know, often it's a very intuitive process, and I'm, you know, between seeing it with my eye and interpreting it with my head and playing it with my hands, there's not a hell of a lot of time between those three things. What I would say is, specifically with Passion of Joan of Arc, that was the first film I'd accompanied, and it's probably considered one of the hardest films of all to accompany. Carl Dreyer himself was apparently even reported as saying he preferred that film to not have music at all. And that's probably one of the few films that I could imagine that working. Or, you know, you could see that film in silence, I think. but I had no idea what I was doing. I had the kind of the confidence of ignorance then, so I didn't realize this was this sort of, you know, great cathedral-like masterpiece. I just, you know, thought it was surprisingly good, you know, and interesting, and made me want to do more. I think because I'd already seen a lot of cinema at that point, when I was studying music at college, I was spending more time in the cinema than I was, you know, listening to music. So I already kind of, I think, had a feeling for cinema and a sort of instinctual understanding of drama. And that helped sort of the interpretive process, I think. As far as improvising is concerned, I mean, sometimes it's completely improvised, sometimes it's not. I mean, the Firstborn, actually, I'll probably be playing a score. I composed a score for a small ensemble for that film, for the London Film Festival a couple of years back, and I'll probably play that score in, you know, pretty much intact. At least, just obviously, it'll be a solo rather than an ensemble. But I, you know, having spent all that time on that score, you know, I might as well play it. But sometimes I, you know, I'm always sort of playing and coming up with bits of music, you know, from day to day, and sometimes I think, oh, that's nice, I must use that. So, you know, I have a couple of themes for Peter Butte, for example, which I want to use, which are just bits of music that I came up with independent of that film, and, you know, I think, oh, that would work well for Louise Brooks, you know. But it's all improvisatory in the sense that even if the notes that are coming from my hands are not, you know, even if that's not the first time that those notes have come out, the application of the music to the film is improvisatory, if that makes sense. You know, even if you have a jazz musician who's riffing on a Gershwin tune, obviously they didn't compose the tune, but it's still improvisation. So it's a question of degree, but I wouldn't put improvisation above composition, and I wouldn't put it above playing the original scores that were composed at the time, or cue sheets. I think they're all very valid ways of accompanying silent films. As I say, the reason why I do it that way is, you know, initially was practical, but it just works for me, and hopefully the audience.
Prix de Beauté, which, you say, just really briefly, was Louise Brooks's last performance. And
I don't think it was her last performance. It was her last famous role. Her last silent film performance.
Okay.
She did a couple of small sound films, I think.
Okay. And includes cinematography from both Louis Ney, who shot The Passion of Joan of Arc, and also Rudolf Maté, who later made films like DOA. And it's kind of has this in common with The Firstborn. It's a mix of different moods and styles. It has comedy, but it also has noir in it at certain points. And Louise Brooks herself has just this quality of freshness and unforced playfulness that she has in her best performances. So I wonder if she's something who's really inspiring to accompany.
Yes. Well, I mean, Louise Brooks is sort of extraordinary performer. She's like she's been photoshopped from the 21st century and sort of put in a time machine, you know. And she's completely modern in her persona. I mean, I regularly fall in love with the actresses in these films. I fell in love with Annie Ondra from The Manx Man, you know. Again, I composed the score for that film, so I had her staring out of, you know, on my computer screen at me for 3 months. It's quite a strange thing, falling in love with someone who's long since passed away. But I think there's something, for me, there's something essentially romantic about silent film, you know, and quite emotive about just, you know, soundless images being blended with music. Sorry, what was the question again? I can't remember.
Just that Louise Brooks, she always has this quality of playfulness, and whatever skill she had as a performer, it doesn't communicate a skillfulness. It communicates his genuine innocence to
me.
Yes,
yes. It does seem very natural. I mean, she seems like an intuitive performer, definitely.
She's sensual, but she's also innocent. And you have this sense of this sexuality that she's almost as much a victim of as a benefiter of. That men destroy themselves over this amazing sexuality that even she's not fully in control of.
That's very, very true, yes. Definitely true of this film, and obviously Pandora's Box. It's kind of like... there are women like that who, you know, men just sort of, you know, they're like unintentional sirens, you know, and men sort of throw themselves on the rocks. And they don't mean the woman doesn't mean the man to do that. It's just, it's sort of how they are. And, these narratives are often quite sort of moralistic in the sense that she suffers, she gets punished for it, which is rather awful. But I find there's something quite... There's a sadness to her persona as well. I don't know if that's because the way the narratives work out, they always work out, with tragic endings. But there's this sort of joyfulness, but sort of this note of melancholy in her. Especially also, because you can't help watching her films without, having the heart, about what happened to her career afterwards. So there's always an element of sadness, knowing that, these few performances are kind of so rare. And the very final scene of Vie de Beauté is kind of an extraordinary final scene. I mean, it's not her final film, but it's effectively her final film in the sense that it's her final starring role. So the last scene is sort of almost, it seems like a metaphor for her career, really.
It's certainly a really striking early example of incorporating cinema into the film's story, where we see her on screen in this theater where they're previewing like a screen test or a performance that she's done.
Screen test for a sound film.
Right, yeah. Okay, screen test for a sound film, of course. And she's just been killed by the man that she left to go and pursue this glamorous life. And they get a shot of her head, still immaculate and beautiful, but she's dead, and in the background she's on the screen, still alive and singing.
That's right. Well, as you can imagine, that's a challenging film to score musically. But I've got a solution to the problem, but I'm not going to tell you what it is, because it's going to be a surprise for people.
But it involves interacting with the music that is presumably in the diegesis?
Yes, you have to, really. Well, you don't have to. You could just play whatever you wanted. I did hear that film accompanied with just music, just carrying on to the end of the film, which was fine, but I've got something planned. It's going to be a good ending. If we bring it off, it will be good.
That's great. Well, Stephen Horn, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
For talking with me.
Thank you.
That's brilliant.